Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
My name is Wendy Kaufman, and you might remember me because back in the 1990s, I started working for a small beverage company called Snapple, and then I ended up on TV as their Snapple lady running around the country, making Snapple dreams come true for fans everywhere. So with that said, I'm so happy to be here today on Sylvia and Me.
Wendy, it's so great to have you here. We talked a little before this, and it turns out we both grew up in Long Island. You grew up in Woodmere. And I would say, as you said, you came from a healthy financial family in Woodmere. What was it like growing up in the 80s? Tell me a little bit about your life before Snapple.
Okay, well, I came from the South Shore of Long Island. We were very diverse. I have to tell you, when Idlewild Airport became Kennedy Airport, many, many backgrounds of people started moving into the area. So I while I was sheltered in many, many ways, it was really diverse, and I just always felt really easy with people. But as I started to get older, I started to realize that I was not comfortable in the body that I was given and that I was wearing, much like many other adolescent young women. I was in a town that fashion and design was very important.
Totally. Yes. That was Long Island. So much of it.
Right. And what happened was, is I had beautiful parents. My parents were like drop dead movie star gorgeous. And I was really the plain older child. You know, let me just tell you, I am the older child. I have a brother and sister who are twins. They are 2 years younger than me. You know, so I was really the paver of the way in the family.
That's funny. But yeah, I'm the oldest of five.
Oh, so you are the oldest also.
Yes.
So we paved the way. And my parents, it was like children bringing up children. My parents met when they were in their teens. My mother got married when she was 19, and she had me when she was 20. So she had three children at 22. And my father was an athlete. My mother, you know, it really mattered. But I have to tell you, you know, when I was born, I was on my first diet. You know, I think this is really relevant and important to the conversation. When I was 6 weeks old, I was already on skim milk because I was just ingesting too much. And when they were starting to take pictures of me on the, you know, couch, I was rolling off the side of the couch, you know. So it was like, oh my God, we got to do something with her. And at two, I was going to the park, you know, I'm in my terrible twos. And I started to show really interesting personality defects because I started beating up other children in the park and taking their ice creams away and eating it myself. And they thought it was funny, you know. trust me, it wasn't funny.
Okay.
So, I have to tell you, by the time 13 rolled around, you know, it was bar mitzvahs every weekend. My mother was a smoker, so I started smoking at a very, very young age, and I was a defiant child as the oldest child, finding my own path and way. My mother was like, what do you mean you're smoking? And I'm like, well, you smoke, why can't I? You know, so it was really, you know, a problem in my family to start curbing me. And by the time the bar mitzvahs came around, it's 13 and there's cigarettes and there's matches on every table and there's drinks and nobody's paying attention. So every weekend it was like Las Vegas in Long Island, where Wendy was smoking and drinking and having a grand old time and eating all this food. And it was like the greatest time of my life, but also very, very sad because I recognized at a young age that I did enjoy covering up my feelings and drinking at that point.
which does cover up at that age. It's a very tender age, going through puberty, feeling so, you know, insecure and hiding it. How did anyone notice, or did
it was such a phenomenally interesting time, Sylvia, because all these people would be at the parties. They weren't paying attention to me. They put a drink on a table. You know what I'm saying? So I would pick it off. And it wasn't like today, you know, where everybody's like hysterical about it. So nobody noticed, but I noticed that I liked the way that I felt in my own skin. I was developing and gaining a couple of pounds here and there. And I was always a size 12 to 14. And I just wasn't comfortable. And that's like a theme for me. My parents, while we lived in the South Shore, they joined a country club in the North Shore. And I just have to tell you, I don't think that there's anything more traumatic to a heavy kid than parents going to a country club where I was. I honestly, it was such a trauma to me because I was such an outsider and I was made to feel like such a black sheep. And it was really heartbreaking because all of the people would set their children up to date each other because it was like that back in the day. And nobody ever asked me to go out with one of their children. So it didn't do anything helpful for me. I remember by the time high school rolled around, I was going to a diet doctor, which was okay. And he was prescribing legally these pills called Christmas trees. No, Christmas tree, it was speed, you know, because we were all going to diets and that was okay because my mother would let me go to the doctor as long as I was going to lose weight. And I remember loving being on speed. And I do remember smoking pot. I wasn't a big fan of pot. It made the back of my throat go, pins and needly or whatever. So I didn't like the feeling of that. But I knew that I really liked drugs. So cut to the chase, I leave high school and I get to Syracuse University, which was my school and a huge party school for anybody who knows Syracuse. But anyhow, you know, it was there. You know, we were really drinking beer because we weren't really beer drinkers, you know, living in Long Island. We were raiding our parents' liquor cabinets. By the time I got to school, I found Quaaludes for the first time, which I just loved. But I also had a moralistic code, and I just felt bad at knowing that my father would be paying for my drug. So I really kept it with beer and alcohol because that was like regular college stuff. So I really didn't imbibe much in the drug scene. But I will tell you, it was the last night of college as I graduated, the night I graduated, that I tried cocaine for the first time. I always sort of had a niggling thought that cocaine was going to do it for me. But I also knew that I just didn't want to be addicted to a drug that my father would be paying for. That just didn't seem right or fair. But I did do it the first night I graduated, and I did love it. And it took me on a 10-year tear to bring me onto my knees when I just knew that I was not only sick in the head, but I knew that I was a drug addict and that either I was going to get help or I just needed to die.
But how did you, I mean, that's something that takes people quite a long time to actually realize and admit to themselves and admitting it and then getting help, reaching out. So how did you actually do that? Did somebody say something to you? Did they notice it? Or did you, you know, confront someone and ask for help?
It's interesting that you say this. I knew for a while that I was in a lot of trouble, but I just remember having the epiphany moment laying in bed one night and saying to myself, oh my God, you are really in trouble, because I just couldn't be without cocaine. I was a 3-pack-a-day smoker at this point, and I remember that there was a part of my life that I just would rather have not been with people and be alone. And I started to gamble every weekend on basketball and hockey and football, anything, because I just liked the stimulation of being high in some way. It didn't matter anymore, but I didn't want people around. While this was happening, I was realizing that outside in the world where I could go on a plane and go visit somebody, I couldn't do that anymore because they were changing the laws and you couldn't smoke on an airplane anymore and you couldn't smoke at a restaurant anymore and you couldn't go to a sporting event or a movie anymore. And here I am, a 3-pack-a-day smoker, so I can't even do anything anymore. So it just really like hit me. Oh my God, I'm like the most unfree person in the entire world. And plus my addictions were really kicking up, that I got to the point with the drugs that if I pressed my cheek, my nose would start bleeding. And that I was so infected in my head. Now, this took a 10-year period. And I just want to say, in that 10-year period, I got engaged to somebody who was a friend of mine who I didn't love. But I figured maybe if I get married, maybe if I do this, and I have children, that will be my answer, that I can get away from drugs and move away and to start a home life. And then I figured one of the nights, what am I, crazy that I'm going to have children like this, that I'm going to get married to somebody that I don't even love? And I just realized how distorted my thinking was. And I got to a point that I just didn't know who I was anymore. And I went to Massachusetts to see if I could just get away from drugs for a weekend. And the epiphany of that weekend was the devastation of knowing I couldn't. And I came home, I was so upset because I really knew at that point that I needed long-term help because I was just so addicted. And I went to a friend's apartment to tell him what was really happening in my life and how terrified that I was for the next step. And my ex-fiance came over and he called me every single brutal name in the book, you fat effing. I can't even tell you the barrage. But at that moment, I believed that everything that he said about me was true. And I went back up to my apartment and I got on my knees for the first time in my life. And I said to myself, God, either help me to get better or kill me now. And the next day, I did so many drugs that night to kill myself. And the next day I was working at that point in our family business. So my father was there, my sister was there, my brother was there, and they knew that I was doing drugs, but I walked in such bad shape. They were so alarmed. I really looked like a dead person. And they got my mother on the phone and I had my intervention, which really wasn't necessary because I was so relieved to get myself caught. And I checked myself in at the end of the week to a hospital in New Jersey, which I thought would be a 28-day stay, which turned into a 45-day stay. And then they called me in and said, there is no way you're going to get better with just 45 days of sobriety. You need to go to a therapeutic community. We have this place for, are you ready for this? Reluctant to recover alcoholics. I only considered myself a coke addict, but they were really determined to take me off everything because I'm such an addict with food, with cigarettes, with everything. And I ended up there for another 8 months. So my 28 days turned into a 10-month ordeal where I went away and got myself well.
Well, good for you.
It was nuts. And part of that, which was the shift in my life, I had been in a family business. My best friend at the time, for many, many years, was a guy, Michael Greenberg. His father, Arnie Greenberg, was one of the owners and the original partners at Snapple. And he watched from the sidelines what was happening with me and in my family business. But as part of my sobriety, they made it clear to my parents that they wanted me thrown out of the business, our family business, so I could restart my life without being a spoiled brat where my parents were picking up after me every step of the way and to make me a responsible adult. So I had to start all over, fired from my family at age 31 with a blank palate. And I was so terrified, I just didn't even know where to begin.
But you did. You began. You started working at Snapple?
Well, what happened was, it's not as clean cut as that because of some false pride that I have along the way. So I get fired. I had never been to an AA meeting. So I knew that it was really, really important that I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and I had to get ensconced into some sort of a group for support and everything. And I knew that I had to get a sponsor and I did all of those things. I went into rehab in 1989 and I got out summer of 1990. And when I started to look for jobs, the economy was just awful. So it was really difficult. I remember one of the guys that was interviewing looked at me and said, "Do you have any intention of losing some weight?" And I said, "No, do you?" You know?
Threw it right back.
No, do you? You know, but, so I would be the second person all the time. It was me and somebody else, and I'd always lose the job. And out in the perimeter was Arnie Greenberg, and he said to me, "You would be great. Why don't you come to Snapple and work for me?" And I just didn't want it to be that easy because of a false pride scenario. And he had asked me once and I said no. He was really patient and he came to me and he cleared it with his partners because they totally had a rule that they didn't want any family or any friends of family working in the business. And plus the fact I'm a drug addict now, you know, I'm being treated for this. So he told them about my story and they all agreed that they would give me a shot to come to Snapple. And what finally changed my mind was that Arnie said, "You know what? I'm not doing you any favors. Don't worry about it. I'm going to start you with $20,000 a year. And this way, you'll learn everything and you'll have to work your way up." And you know what? That became incredibly enticing for me.
You're very lucky to have someone who believed in you that much, who really wanted to give you that chance, and you were willing to take it.
He was incredible. He certainly believed in me much more at that point than I would ever believe in myself. But you know what? They stuck me in the order department because everything started there. And I started to learn who the distributors were. And I started to see who was like a verbal abuser, who wasn't, what their personalities were, all the flavors. And I started at $20,000. And suddenly, you know, nobody wanted to do the letters that were just emerging. We were small. Nobody wanted to take on extra work. And here I'm starting to get letters from the community for sponsorships, for donations, for letters just letting us know how much they love the brand.
I want to go back to one thing that you had said on one of your interviews, that no one was opening up these letters. And one of the reasons you remembered that when you were a child, you wrote your one and only fan letter to Greg Brady.
Yes.
From the Brady family, and you never got an answer. So did that kind of catapult you to go,
You know, it's so funny because you're right. I wrote one fan letter in my life to Greg. I loved Barry Williams. You just have no idea. You know, we were all coming up in the Brady Bunch. So all the guys loved Jan and Marsha, and all the girls loved Christopher Knight. And, you know, it was so hilarious. But it must have been like a Tiger Beat thing. And I really wanted to meet Greg Brady. Never got, you know, got an answer. And I'm watching the mail. But I also know something else. I also know that the best place for me to be is out of my own head and doing nice things for other people, because I know that that's an integral part of me remaining sober. So I went to Arnie and I said to him, remembering how meaningful it would have been for me to receive a letter as a child, I went to Arnie and said, you know what? People are writing to this company and nobody is returning their mail to them with some answers. I said, we want to be friends with these people. We want to connect with these people. He let me, and I left the order department, soon after, and I became like the Snapple lady without being the Snapple lady. I got on a chair and I literally made myself the head of public relations because I could publicly relate.
Yes, you could.
And they doubled my salary. And in a year from then, I was already earmarked to be in the commercials. So I was on the air so I got out of rehab in 1990. I went to Snapple in 1991. At the end of 1992, I was filming commercials, the first 12, and doing radio commercials. The head of marketing pointed me out to our new ad agency that we had hired, and they saw me and they said, oh my God, because I was at my desk, very irreverent and hilarious, answering the mail, and I was like the queen of Snapple. It was the greatest time of my life, and even better because I felt so great in my skin, and it felt the best doing nice things for people that I was able to do.
And you were, as you said, you were known as the Snapple lady. In fact, the trademark for the commercials was you were sitting behind your desk and basically they showed your head and you were peering over the reception counter, giving the impression that you were incredibly short. and you would begin each commercial with, of course, your thick New York accent. Well, I don't think I have an accent, and we both come from Long Island. It was great. It sounds like it was a fantastic time in your life. You're partially responsible for a jump in their sales from like 23 million to 750 in the time you were there.
Yeah, they used to call me the billion dollar babe, but it was just so unbelievably remarkable to go from nothing to just the most joyous place that I could possibly be, and to have somebody who really believed in me. And I have to tell you that they all knew about it, so I never felt like I was lying to anybody. And I got to a point where it's like, oh my God, I could never let these people down, because look at what they've done. But I have to tell you, the funniest part of the whole thing is that I call up my parents when I found out that I was going to be in all the Snapple commercials. I called them up to tell them, and my mother is like, Ronnie, what is she talking about? What do you mean you're going to be in the commercials? You're not an actress. Why would they put you in the commercials? I'm like, it's a long story, but they're putting me in the commercials. Ronnie, she's back on drugs. Ronnie.
Oh, that's
Ronnie,
great.
Why would they put my fat Long Island child on TV to be the star of the Snapple campaign? So I'm like, no, I'm not on drugs. I'm telling you, I'm going on TV and I'm going to, take over where I can, put my stamp of approval and make it a better world. And honestly, it was just the funniest thing on so many levels, but it felt unbelievable. Great, to know that, people believed in me enough for me to really believe in myself. And I remember, and this is the most important part of it, is that I was so happy. And I remember that one particular day I'm looking in the mirror, and instead of seeing the imperfections that I always saw in my face, where I had a pimple and I had a wrinkle and I had a line or this, I finally looked into my eyes and I saw the sparkle in my eyes and I started to cry. And I said to myself in the mirror, you are never, ever going to lose the sparkle in your eye. And I swore to myself from now on, I was going to capture and hold the sparkle in my eye, and I have never lost it since.
Oh, wow. That's it. That is the most important thing, to be able to look yourself in the mirror and say, I'm okay. I'm good. I like myself. I'm doing real good. That is the most important thing, because until you do that, yes, people believed in you, but now you can walk around and have that secure feeling within yourself.
It's so interesting. Yes.
So crucial.
You can't be anything to anyone unless you love yourself, because until you love yourself, it's really impossible for you to really love big other people. It starts from you. Somebody reminded me that when you get on a plane, you know, and they tell you, you know, if something happens, put the oxygen mask on yourself first, because you can't save anyone else unless you save yourself first. And you know what? It's so true about life. And we all have incredible trials, incredible tribulations, but it is up to us to really, you know, examine, you know, what is the faulty wiring? We all have it. We're all imperfect. But what is remarkable, Sylvia, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, we take our cars to the shop to get tuned up. And usually it may be just a small wire that can just dislodge an entire vehicle. And that's what I'm saying about people. It could be the smallest thing that just has to get an adjustment to make the bigger picture perfect. You know what I mean? And that's all that it takes sometimes, to go see a therapist, to work on something, you know, take an inventory, be brutally honest. What is your defect? Because a lot of times your biggest defect is your greatest asset. So really see who you are, really know who you are, and what can you do better, and how can you be a better listener? How can you share better? How can you give people better? Because in giving is what, there is nothing better than in giving, because you get a million times back what you give.
Wendy, the journey that you've taken and the courage that you have within yourself then and now, and not losing that sparkle, I give you a lot of credit. There's so many people who can't do it, but it's something that your message is a great message, because it is so true. If you don't look in the mirror and be able to say, yes, I like who I'm seeing, I might have this, this, and this, it doesn't make a difference. You have proved that. I mean, going from an addict, the drugs, the not feeling good about yourself, all of the different journeys you've gone through, and you were able, yes, you know, these people believed in you. The people at Snapple, Arnie Greenberg, believed in you and gave you that chance. But if you didn't have that within you, you wouldn't have been able to take that chance and do what you did with your life.
It's true. We all have to take a risk. It's so interesting. Joan Rivers was the first person who asked me to come on a TV show. And I thought about it, and I knew that a window had opened, and I knew that I was terrified, but I also knew that if I didn't try, I would never know what the outcome would be and what was the worst thing that was going to happen, that I screwed up on national television. Well, if I screwed up, people would feel bad for me anyway. So there was no downside to it, because you always love an underdog that passes out on TV or something. So anyhow, I really thought it through, and I've really spent my life seeing what doors and windows of opportunity open. That's how I met you, Sylvia, because I'm right? I mean, we met each other because my doors and windows are open. I think that networking and knowing people and really knowing people is just critical. If I can help connect somebody, I'm happy to do it. And that's really the gift of life and being alive. And I'm so grateful to so many who sat with me and gave me the gift of sobriety, which I'm just celebrating 30 years, which is just unbelievable. It's incumbent upon me to pay it forward. And listen, I'm not perfect. I'm an addict. Everything about me is an addict. I can't even watch TV shows without being an addict. I can't go on the scale and be on an eating plan where I don't go on the scale 150 times a day. So I just can't go on the scale except maybe once a night and just bash myself. I laugh because I do love who I am and who I turned out to be. I still am an addict with my eating, but I'm happy to report that I had lost about 45 pounds. And I just got on the scale the other day because I'm getting double knee surgery in a couple of weeks. I just had to give them my weight. I was having a heart attack. I didn't want to go on the scale. So they yelled at me at the hospital and said, "We have to know your weight. We need it for the anesthesia."
See, I make them, they're never allowed to tell me what it is.
So I had to get on the scale, and not only was it painful, but it was with my sneakers and my coat and everything. So anyhow, the net is that now I know. And yesterday I got back on my eating plan. The good news was is I kept to up 35 pounds. Okay. So I'm not starting, you know what I'm saying? I'm not starting from the beginning.
I know.
So that's fantastic. But I didn't beat my, that's what I want to tell everybody. I didn't beat myself up. I said, "Oh my God, this is a miracle. You kept off 35. Now you're going to do the next 30. And then you'll do the next 30. But you know what? I will do it. Just like I've done everything else. It comes in its own time. But do I love myself? I absolutely do. If somebody says and calls me fat, I'm like, oh, a true epiphany. Like, I didn't figure that out myself. Like, but it, you're really, really smart. That is real fighting words. If you own it, nobody can take your power away from you. Nobody can hurt you anymore.
So is that the message? I was going to ask you, what message would you like to leave? And it almost sounds like that's the message.
It really is. The message to everybody, other than loving yourself, is just when you are strong enough to own exactly who you are, you have now taken the power away from everyone else, and no one can hurt you. Because once you own it, you are it, and who cares what anybody thinks?
Wendy, this has been absolutely fantastic. You are not just a delight, you're an absolutely wonderful person. I mean, what fun talking to you and the message you have. I want to thank you so much for allowing us to come into your life and sharing your story and being a part of Sylvia and Me and our podcast.
Thank you so much, Sylvia. It's a pleasure. And you see, Snapple even brought you to me.
There you go. Thanks. P.S. Wendy did finally get to meet Greg Brady, who gave her a dozen roses. Thank you for joining me today. On our next podcast, I'll be talking with another extraordinary woman. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and of course, our website, lifeofprey.com. Listen, subscribe for free, and take us with you wherever you are. This has been a Life of Prey production.